Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Rents are even higher than pre-pandemic levels. According to Apartment List's latest monthly report, the national median rent has increased by just over 11%. To put that in context, from 2017 to 2019, rent growth averaged just 3%. So we're talking 11% versus 3%. Rents are outpacing pre-pandemic averages in 98 of the nation's 100 largest cities. A couple of weeks ago, we did a show about a recent National Low-Income Housing Coalition report, which found that no one working full-time, making the federal minimum wage, can afford to rent a two-bedroom apartment anywhere in the United States. According to the report, a full-time worker would need to earn at least $20 an hour to rent a modest one-bedroom home, or almost $25 an hour to rent a modest two-bedroom home. Home prices are also drastically increasing. As of June, median existing home sales prices are up just over 23% from a year earlier. The median home costs about five times the median household income, pricier than in the run-up to the 2008 housing crash, according to Harvard researchers. According to reports, pension funds, investment firms, and Wall Street banks are snapping up family homes in the United States at a rapid pace as prices rocket higher. Soaring home prices are forcing potential homebuyers to rent. There are currently over 115 million renters in the United States, according to the Rental Protection Agency. So to make the situation even more dire, millions of renters now face the prospect of losing their homes after the Supreme Court struck down the Biden administration's eviction moratorium. Joining us to talk about all of this are two guests. Connor Doherty is economics reporter at the New York Times, focusing on real estate and wage stagnation. Connor is the author of Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America, which was released earlier this year. And he joins us from his home in Oakland. Hi, Connor. Thanks so much for joining us. And I'm sorry about the technical issues last week.
No, it's we all know about technical issues. Forgive me if my daughter comes in screaming.
No problem. Thank you so much for joining us. We're also joined by Elizabeth Kneebone, a research director for the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley. They come up with strategies to house families from all walks of life in vibrant, sustainable, and affordable homes and communities. Elizabeth co-led a recent report called Paying the Rent in a Pandemic: Recent Trends in Rent Payments Among Affordable Housing Tenants in California. Hi, Elizabeth. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Great to have both of you. Connor, I want to start off with you because you wrote a piece about this Supreme Court ruling. Supreme Court's decision opens door to millions of evictions. As you report, millions of people now face the prospect of losing their homes. So this happened last Thursday. Can you give us any updates? What's happening on the ground?
What's happening is we are in what is basically a race against time. We've had, you know, the estimate for the number of vulnerable tenants is kind of all over the place, but it's in the millions, or it's over 1 million. And we were around the country having difficulty distributing these rental funds that have been allotted for the purpose of keeping these people in their homes, which is a public health imperative, since most people, when they're evicted, go to live with someone else. We know that crowded homes is like one of the number one risk factors for COVID spread. So keeping people stable isn't just, you know, a just thing in terms of, you know, their housing security and all that. It helps us turn the page on COVID faster. So now we're in this race. Evictions can begin. They were already starting to begin in a lot of places. And how can we figure out how to either divert some of these evictions? So a number of cities have set up diversion programs, and the way that works is, you know, the landlord and the tenant go to a court and some officer pulls them aside and says, sort of, you basically have to try to work out some arrangement. And then the other is getting this rental assistance to people, which is which is really hard and has faced a lot of hurdles. I think one of the things this is highlighting that Elizabeth and I have spoken about for, I guess, years now, is we had a housing crisis before COVID, and this is just illustrating that. And one of the things that this Supreme Court case and then subsequently the sort of mad dash to try to keep people in their homes has illustrated is we don't have any kind of real federal housing program. Now, we have Section 8 vouchers. We have other kinds of what are, you know, nationwide housing sort of efforts, if you will. But there's no, we don't know who every landlord in the country is. We don't know who every tenant is. We don't even know what properties, aside from, you know, a couple of large apartment buildings, which is a small minority of the built environment in America, we don't really even know where all the rental units are. You know, we get some census surveys and whatnot. Now, that's very different than, say, owner occupancy, where we have, you know, a deed of basically every house. We know who owns it. Any, if you have a mortgage, there's these vast mortgage service sort of apparatus, you know, companies that can, you know, play a very big role in distributing aid and whatnot. So this is just like a totally different animal. A rental crisis is just a totally different animal than, say, the 2008 housing crisis, where you have, you know, just reams of documentation for who owns what and all that. So what we're trying to do is sort of create programs that we should have had, you know, however many decades ago. And we're trying to create them in the middle of a public health crisis with like this eviction thing bearing down. Mm-hmm. So it's just about as hard of a situation as you could imagine. And we're sort of seeing the results, which I don't want to say they're anyone's fault. Individually, they're sort of our collective fault for never having anything like this before.
Connor, you make a really important point here. Why don't we have answers to the questions that you raised? Because there are, and I want to talk with both of you during the show about this, but like CNN, for example, headline, Wall Street is buying up family homes. The rent checks are just too juicy to ignore. And then there are some statistics about more than 23 million American landlords own more than one home. And whenever we do shows about housing, we always ask, well, how many of these are small landlords and how many are, you know, pension funds or the Blackstones of the world? So why don't we have answers to these questions?
I don't think, well, so because I guess the answer is we don't really, like, if you know who owns a piece of property, I guess we've never really thought too deeply about what they're doing with it. You know, if they're living in it or they're renting it, aside from they say they're paying their income taxes, our government has never really thought too deeply about what's happening in there. If you know, as long as it's not like criminal or whatever, right? I think that is starting to change, though. There's a legislator in California named Buffy Wicks. She happens to be my legislator, that's sort of just a coincidence, who is, you know, assemblywoman. And she's been trying for several years to do like a rental registry. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this predates COVID. But my point is, her fundamental question is, we know nothing about any of this. We're trying to design all these programs for all these vulnerable renters, and we basically know nothing. So there are people who have been aware of this problem and been trying to fix it, you know, before COVID. So I guess my answer is we've never really tried. There are certain questions we never really asked, and I guess we are now asking them because we're realizing that rental apartments is, you know, is a huge piece of how people will live for life. It's a huge, you know, it has applications to public health and all this. And also because, you know, Wall Street landlords are buying into this. Now, I should note, even though Wall Street has been buying a lot of housing lately, and that's a whole policy debate. Most properties are still owned by smallish landlords. You know, they're either individual mom and pops, or they're like small groups of people who own, you know, it's like a bunch of rich doctors get together and start a fund or something. I guess we call them the ordinary rich, but you know, you know, and they may own 10 or 20 properties and they have a small company and one manager, right? You know, so there's not, there are not like that many large, there are not that many homes that are owned by a large nationwide operator. But that's changing, but it's still not changing fast enough that it's like anywhere close to a large percentage of all the housing stock.
Right. Well, so Elizabeth, given the work that you do with the Turner Center for Housing, you all come up with strategies to house families of all walks of life in vibrant, sustainable, and affordable homes and communities. There's so much to unpack here because things have changed so much in terms of costs with rent, with home prices, Airbnb. As Connor said, a lot of these places are being bought by Wall Street speculators and pension funds, but most of them are still owned by mom and pop landlords. Given where we are right now, and given that this is not just a California issue, this is a nationwide crisis, how do you think about these issues? Like, what really concerns you the most right now?
So I think there are so many issues that Connor's put on the table that show how many of these challenges were just pre-existing, and then you layer a crisis on top of it, and it really throws into sharp relief the inefficiencies and sort of brokenness or inadequacies of the system that we had before. Like the point about a rental registry, it seems like, is that really that important? But it is incredibly important, even before the crisis, when we think about things like, the state implemented a cap on rent increases to try and guard against gouging and sort of unsustainable, rent increases from year to year. But we don't actually have any baseline data that shows us what rents are being charged right now. How do we know if this is actually being implemented effectively if we don't know where we were starting from and we don't have regular data to sort of track how renters are faring and how these, things are shifting across different markets? That's just within California, but that's true across the country as well. We have very piecemeal efforts here. Some communities have a rent registry or some way of tracking business licenses. How well are those actually maintained? How much information do we have? All that becomes important when you're trying to get your hands around who owns these properties. The best estimates we've seen is it's something like 2% of small properties, the sort of 1 to 4 unit buildings, are owned by institutional investors. A lot of these are individuals that may own 1 to even, dozens of properties, but they're not these professionalized big Wall Street groups. And that makes it a really fragmented system. And without that information of who they are and where they are, it gets really hard to do something like stand up rent relief. Because how do we make sure that we are targeting those landlords who tend to be where some of the biggest hits have occurred since COVID? Some of the things we've been doing at the Turner Center to understand the impacts on rent payments, the data that's most readily available tends to be in these large multifamily professionalized landlords, but that's a small share of the stock. We've put out a survey among smaller property landlords, so that 1 to 4 unit stock, and we're seeing much higher impacts in terms of more like 1 in 3 landlords saying that they've lost revenue, they've lost rent collections compared to the year before the pandemic. And yet 2/3 of landlords that reported arrears in this sort of smaller stock hadn't even explored a rental relief program by March of this year. So that's a real challenge because it suggests that there are a lot of people who may be particularly vulnerable, may have renters who are particularly vulnerable, who aren't aware of these programs or how to connect with them. And we don't have the sort of ready-made database of addresses to say, to make people aware. And I think that's part of the challenge of really sort of catching up with getting this rental assistance out. The other point that I think Connor made that's really important is we didn't have these systems in place before. Now we have nearly $50 billion to put out, but we're doing it through this really patchwork, 50 different states, thousands of jurisdictions that can opt if they have more than 200,000 people to implement the program themselves. It's like standing up, creating from whole cloth a thing that didn't exist before, and you're doing it thousands of times. You may be slightly different in the way that they are targeting or the way that they're requiring application materials. That's really put a wrench in trying to get those important resources out. And then you compound that with not having a lot of information about who might need it most or who landlords are and where they are. The research we've been doing on the multifamily affordable space I think you're looking there at tenants who are sort of in the best position in that they're already in affordable housing, that their rents are already restricted. And especially mission-driven organizations that have things like resident services can mobilize much more quickly to understand what that local landscape of support, even before the federal relief came online. Those types of landlords and owners, operators were able to think about, does your county have a rent relief program? Does your is there a nonprofit nearby that has assistance that we can connect you to? And even still in that community, we were still seeing tenants fall short on rent because of lost earnings and the impacts of the economic shutdown. So if anything, it really, like I said, underscores what a piecemeal system we have that is just all layering on top of each other in the middle of such a crisis to make a sort of coordinated and fast striking response difficult to stand up.
So you brought up a number of points there. According to the census, 6 million people are behind on their rent. According to the Center on Budget Priorities, I believe 11 million people are behind on their rent. Attorney General Merrick Garland just spoke yesterday, basically calling on the legal community to step up to help people because so many people are afraid that they're going to be evicted in the next 2 months. I mean, this is devastating to think about, Elizabeth, that millions of people could potentially be evicted in the coming month or two?
Absolutely. And in the middle of what is still a health crisis, where we still are seeing, surges. And, research has shown that where some of these evictions tend to cluster and have still been clustering, even with this moratorium, the protections weren't complete, are often in places that have lower vaccination rates, where we've seen the negative impacts of when protections lift on actual infection rates and health outcomes. So it's incredibly alarming that's where we've come to, and how do we bridge that gap, sort of where we began this conversation? How do we make sure that we allow more space to get these resources in place so that we can avoid that wave? And I think we're seeing things like Michigan saying they will implement a 45-day stay to make sure that if before a proceeding, an eviction can proceed, they have to make sure that they're allowing some time for those tenants to be able to connect with emergency relief. Or in Texas saying, if you're being served with notice of an eviction proceeding, you have to also be providing those tenants with information about rental relief. And really, it's not in the best interest of the landlord either necessarily to evict people without connecting to those resources. On either end, it's the better outcome is to figure out how to get these monies available and into the hands that most need them.
Okay, so to that point, can let's talk about that for another minute, because Diane Yentl, the president of the National Low Income Housing Coalition, said that some landlords are refusing the emergency rental assistance. She tweeted, "They're refusing to accept the money. Those in hot rental markets have a new incentive to evict, raise rents for new tenants, and make more money in the long run." So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, again, I think that's a good note to really be careful about lumping all landlords together, because there is a lot of diversity among this population where we can distinguish between, there are less resourced, lower income landlords who may only have a few properties that maybe we've seen in the survey work we've done and some survey work coming out of Harvard's Joint Center, that may be looking to sell their properties because they can't maintain without rent relief or without rent payments coming through. They can't maintain their properties. That's different than a landlord that's taking this sort of strategy of trying to, they just want to terminate the relationship because they think they can get more rent. So, I mean, in some ways it calls for different sorts of policy responses. And that's where I think you having that, making sure like in California showing, that you have actually taken steps to get rent relief before you can proceed with the eviction. That's where those sorts of policies can provide another layer of protection.
Right. And we've done so many shows about housing, and we know that there are a wide range of landlords. I know of a small mom and pop landlord that raised rents during COVID, and then know of other landlords who have multiple properties who've done everything they can to keep people in their homes. So of course there's a wide range here, and we're not painting a broad brush. But Diane Yentl just wrote many landlords. Connor, you have written about the money that has been distributed and has not been distributed. I mean, so much of it has not been distributed. Diane Yentl writes that in places like, for example, Florida, they've spent 1.8% of the emergency rent allocation, New York 0.3%, Oregon 4.7%. What is it going to take to ensure that this money gets out?
Well, so like I said, this all just kind of comes back to we don't have anything like this in the country. So let me just give you a point of comparison. If we want to increase unemployment checks to people, as we did at the very beginning of COVID, you can do that basically with the flick of a switch. We have a vast unemployment system. Yes, there were fraud and other things, but I just, you know, they wanted to make unemployment, it was still relatively hard to get, but you know, but if you had to stand in line, whatever. But the point is, we wanted to vastly increase unemployment checks. We just did it, right? We wanted to send stimulus money to basically everyone who filed a tax return the year before. We just did it, right? That's because we have, you know, an IRS, and it's because we have an unemployment system that every state administers. We don't have anything like that for rental. So as I said, every single one of these states is building their own program basically from scratch, you know, the moment the money comes out. So, I mean, $50 billion sounds like a lot of money, and it is, but it's basically a check. What would you do if you had a $50 billion check that you were supposed to, you know, give to everyone who is, you know, in need for rental assistance? You would start going, well, how do I find out who these people are? How do I verify that there's who they say they are? How do I make sure they pay their landlord, right? You would go through all these questions that all these states are individually going through. And then they have to create all these programs, and they got to hire IT people to set up websites, and they got to, you know, create all these things. And I think a lot of that has been, though it's obviously very negative for the tenants, it's been sort of positive in the sense that they're learning all these things that they should have learned a long time ago, right? And they're doing it on the fly, and so it's really difficult. Now, if you're a tenant, obviously all you see is gross incompetence, and you know, in your most dire time of need, and it's just like really distressing to you. But to see it from the government's perspective for a moment, somebody just drops $50 billion on them, and then, you know, has a bunch of press conferences about how they're not giving it out fast enough. You know, while they're sitting there trying to answer all these questions that, you know, the Washington people who give them the $50 billion have just like never even tried to answer. So it's, I think that, you know, there is a lot going on here. Now, what is going to happen? So Treasury has made it way easier. So let me just give you an example with California. When California stood up its first statewide rental relief program in January, there was a state rental relief program, and as Elizabeth alluded to, jurisdictions over 200,000 have their own programs. California has 49 such jurisdictions, by far the largest in the United States. So there are, on day one in January, 50 pots of rental relief money in California, 50 different pots of rental relief money. So suddenly all those 50 pots have to get together and be like, oh, wait, what are you doing? What are you doing? How do we all have one program? How do we all make sure that people aren't applying to all of our programs? How do we, you know, so it's just like all these questions have to get answered. Okay, so today they have basically two pots of money, you know, meaning they've figured out how to get all the 48 of the 49 together, plus the state program. So they've been able to come up with one sort of set of criteria, one sort of system. So originally they weren't allowed to pay. So originally they were not allowed to give people money unless they had some sort of landlord relationship. So they either had to submit a formal lease, or they had to somehow like write a letter with their landlord. They had to sort of, demonstrate a relationship of who they were paying. Well, what did that do? It left out basically everyone with a sublease, right? So, which is like a lot of people and certainly a lot of vulnerable people, you know, overcrowded homes, whatever, all the people who are not specifically on the lease just like couldn't apply. Now the state was able to give those people 25% of the money. And then they were eligible for eviction protections. But, you know, then of course they're accruing all this debt. Well, today they're allowed to give 100% of the money to tenants. They have to like try to demonstrate, that they have a landlord, but if, you know, but if they can't do it, they can still get the money. That would take a while though. I mean, I don't know how long. I mean, it would take like weeks, you know. I mean, it would be a much longer timeline than say someone who submits everything and it's like perfect on day one. So, you know, there are all these sort of things they have to go through, and they all just kind of they all kind of illustrate this broken system. Now, I should note there is like a little bit of good news. I mean, the state of California specifically has like quintupled its rate of distribution. It's still not fast enough, and I'm sure that there are plenty of tenants that would give you nightmare stories. But the point is, it's going up faster than it was. And so I think we're starting to get somewhere. But you know, it's I mean, and one other thing I would just sort of add. You know, just going back a little bit, we originally had some sort of rental relief as part of the CARES Act, which Donald Trump passed in, or, you know, signed in, I don't know, March, right at the beginning of coronavirus, right? But that was like completely inadequate. It was a very small pot of money, right? So all these states had to set up all these programs then, but they sort of knew they'd run out, so they didn't like do too much. Well, then they get new money in December. Well, what did they do? And that money still wasn't enough. So what did they do? They tried to create programs. They would have the largest number of people they could get to. So meaning they did this thing where the landlord had to, basically they wanted to spread the money out. So they made it a little harder to get, to make sure that they didn't run out, right? Well, then they got even more money. So they made the program more generous. Now, if they would have known a year ago that they, that all this money was going to be coming, they might've set up everything way differently. Right. But again, when this is all happening on the fly, and it's happening with a Treasury Department that's changing how much money, changing the criteria of the money, it's just like, you know, and remember, if they sort of mess this up, these states who, though the budget problems have not been nearly as bad as people thought they would be, you know, they don't want to get into a situation where they have to pay the government back. If they, you know, if they give out the money in the wrong way or something, there is like this threat they could have to pay back the Treasury Department. So each time the Treasury changes the guidance, they can loosen the program up a little bit. But even then, they're trying to be a little conservative. So what will it take? I guess it's just going to take us going through this, and it's all speeding up. I mean, and these informal arrangements that I'm putting out, these are like not fringe cases. LA County has like, LA City has something like 50,000, this UCLA study has something 50,000 illegal units. Now, these are not some, you know, weird dungeon apartment. These are like, you know, apartments. These are like, you know, usually they're accessory dwelling units that sit behind a home, but they look like normal. Every, you know, people drive by them and they go, oh, someone lives there. That's fine. You know, it's not some weird thing. This is like a very crucial part of the housing stock. That's LA City. LA County has like 200,000 of those, right? So none of those people, and we know that the people who are most likely to become like literally homeless, meaning, you know, in a shelter or on the street or in their car, are people who do not have any kind of formal lease. You know, it's very rare that someone gets evicted from like a, you know, normal leaseholding apartment kind of arrangement and goes straight to homelessness. It's usually these kind of more marginal cases, you know, overcrowded homes, subleases, illegal units, that people who are the most vulnerable. But they're like specifically the hardest people to find because their landlords don't want to participate because they're doing this illegally. You know, often there's language barriers and internet barriers and all these things, right? So I guess what I'm saying is like, what is this going to take? It's going to take, I mean, this is why the eviction moratorium is so important, because it's giving a little bit of cushion for us to figure out this thing in a couple of months that we should have figured out, you know, however many decades ago. So what it's going to take is the Treasury loosening up even more, and states kind of listening.
Well, to your point, Poynter had a piece about how the number of people living in their cars is growing. A Graham Press with UC San Francisco says you will soon see, if you're not already, more people living in cars, vans, and RVs. We're going to take a quick break. Today we are talking about the housing crisis in this country. After the break, we'll talk about why rents and housing costs are so incredibly high. And is this our new norm, or is a bubble going to burst soon? We're joined today by Connor Doherty, economics reporter with the New York Times and author of Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America. Elizabeth Kneebone is research director for the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley. They come up with strategies to house families in vibrant, sustainable, and affordable homes and communities. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll find out why Democrats like Representative Josh Gottheimer of New Jersey are standing in the way of the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill we've been telling you about. Democrats cannot lose more than 3 votes in the House. And then later in the show, we'll discuss California's Prop 22, which allows companies like Uber and DoorDash to classify their workers as independent contractors, meaning they do not have to provide them with benefits. Well, a California judge ruled that Prop 22 is unconstitutional. We hope you can join us for tomorrow's show. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. If you'd like to join today's conversation about the affordable housing crisis across the country, if you have any stories to share, if you've been in a city for a long time, what changes have you noticed when it comes to rentals and housing costs? And if you have a personal story to share, if you are struggling with rent, if you are dealing with a crisis because of COVID, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Connor Doherty, economics reporter with the New York Times and author of Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America. Elizabeth Kneebone is research director for the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley. Just a basic question on rent. The national median rent has increased by over 11% this year. In 2017 to 2019, it was about 3%. So, Elizabeth, what explains the huge spike in rents?
I think you sort of alluded to this in the beginning of the segment, that in part this reflects how expensive it's gotten to buy homes. A very, very distinct and different than what we saw in the Great Recession, which was very much fueled by the foreclosure crisis. This time around, again, we've seen impact more deeply on renters. I think in perhaps sort of underscoring how uneven the impact of this latest crisis has been, we've seen home prices really soaring and the tightening of inventory on the market. On one hand, that creates its own challenges, especially with access to home ownership, which has already had been fraught with disparities by race and income. But what that also does is it puts a lot of pressure on the rental market and can drive rents up, because more people, if they're not able to buy, maybe opting for rent, for rentals. And then that makes it even more challenging for those lower down the income distribution who are now facing much higher rents. And in part, so sort of that's just the dynamic between ownership and rental. I think in some markets, and especially in California, we also know that we just haven't been building enough housing stock. We just don't have enough homes for folks. And so that in itself also puts sort of upward pressure on rents.
Right. And we'll talk about that later in the show. The thing about this rental crisis is New York and San Francisco get a lot of headlines because it's so ridiculously expensive to live in these places. But we're seeing rent spikes over 10% in Phoenix, Boise, Las Vegas, Stockton, California. The Washington Post spoke with Lauren Campos, a renter in Phoenix, Arizona. And in June, she got a notice on her door saying that her rent was going up $400 a month, a 33% increase. So what would you add, Connor? What explains these massive rent increases?
So Elizabeth explained a lot of it. So whatever we, the same thing happened during the Great Recession. rents flatlined very briefly and then just shot up, right? And I think one thing we forget is that our housing market has a lot of mobility priced into it. People have children, they go and they buy a home, they change their living arrangement. People graduate from college, they go and get their first apartment. People, you know, get jobs. You know, people are constantly moving around, trying to sort of find a new arrangement that works for them. And when we have something like COVID, something that gums it all up, you know, the inventory of homes for sale is like half of what it was. And that was already pretty low, right? So when you have all these kind of, when you have some sort of, you know, schism that that messes up that, you know, kind of natural moving process, and in addition, tanks construction, which you know, probably doesn't matter in any one year, but we were already at a very, you know, shortage of homes, you get this problem where, you know, a few people are trying to make those moves, right? And other people aren't making those moves. And so there's just this sort of like, you know, frozen market, and the very little inventory left, people just go and bid up. And you're seeing that happen with rents. You're seeing that happen with homes. You know, the home price side, I'm not that worried about. And I feel like it'll chill out eventually. The rent side I am worried about, because that's been happening. A, it affects more vulnerable people, and B, it's been happening for like a really long time. So, you know, so a bit, yeah. So, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is this, like, you know, there's a lot of life moves associated with housing, and when they get, you know, all kind of, like I said, gummed up, it really puts pressure on the inventory that is for rent or is for sale.
Well, I do want to, you make a great point about being more concerned about rent because it affects vulnerable people, but I do want to ask you about housing costs and where you think this is going, because I grew up in Sonoma County. My parents bought their home in 1970 something, I think maybe one, for $75,000. Similar homes are now on the market for $800,000. I never thought I would see a new house in Roanoke Park, pretty small, sell for $800,000. I never thought I would see this. So if over the course of 45 years, a home goes from $75,000 to almost $1 million, Elizabeth, is this a bubble? Or, I mean, at what point does this stop?
I think that's a great question. And I think it really depends on the market that we're talking about. You know, in terms of I think what we're seeing, especially in the Bay Area and in California, is we've seen talked about upward pressure on rents. We've seen an upward skew of incomes as people with lower incomes or even moderate $50,000 to $100,000 a year are, more of them are moving out than are moving in, and it's sort of skewing this. We're attracting a lot of you know, highly educated, high paid workers, and the challenge again is that this falls hardest on those with the least resources. We also have seen, you know, commutes really balloon, especially for lower income and moderate income workers who have to move further out to be able to afford housing, and that has negative impacts on those peoples, on those workers, also in terms of our environmental impacts as well, just with the lengthening of commutes. What's hard to see is exactly how this is going to correct. Like we saw this, you know, just within the sort of impact of on rents, as you were mentioning, you know, San Francisco actually is still, it's, we saw rents soften. It's been rising, still not up to where it was, but pre-pandemic, but significantly above the nation, right? So even this sort of small correction is just a sort of temporary trend. Eventually, I think it will slow, it will even out, but it's hard to see how it will ever, you know, reset to the same levels. I think it just has impacts on, and again, who is moving in, who's moving out, and who can afford to live here and to work the jobs that are still located in the region.
What do you think, Connor? Is what we're seeing with housing costs for a home, is this a bubble or will this continue? Because I can't imagine, yeah. I mean, over 40 years going from $75,000 to $1 million, what's going to happen in the next 40 years?
Well, I don't want to not to get too, in the weeds here, but I try to stay away from the term bubble unless I, so when I think of a bubble, a classic bubble, it usually means somebody's buying something purely because they think it's going to go up in value. Right. And so there are, when people buy empty condos for that reason or something like that, that's usually typical bubble behavior. Right. When there's a huge amount of debt in the system, as there was in 2006, meaning the 2006 housing boom was largely caused by making it much easier to finance homes by, obviously basically giving people money that they couldn't afford to pay back. Right. So that is usually what I think of when I think of a classic bubble. Right. This does not exhibit that. What are people complaining about? They're complaining about cash offers. They're complaining about investors, big investors, not crazy hairdresser investors or whatever, buying, homes because the rent is so high, right? So I think I think housing prices could fall? Just absolutely. You know what I mean? Because we are looking at a situation that was, as I sort of said, the inventory of homes for sale has fallen so far that all the demand is going to a very select number of homes. If, we just get back to a normal inventory, that alone could slow the increases, which is, not going to be super relieving to anyone. It's not going to result in a big discount, but, it could just lead to a market that's a little more normal. But I wouldn't really call that a bubble popping either. Right. Look, California was about as expensive as the nation. It was a little bit lower, but, roughly the same as the national median in 1970. By 1980, it was like 50% more. And that's only gotten worse over that period that you just described. Right. Like it goes up a little every year. Every now and then there's a recession and it kind of dials back. But the long term trend is this sort of jagged line that goes up, 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 up with some, minimal falls down over a couple months or a year period, right? So that, as Elizabeth sort of said, that long line, you can't just undo that 40-year upward line, right? And I guess that we're, and so that then you sort of started getting into a longer-term question. Okay, we're in this, so just to sort of complete the question, do I think home prices will start to chill out? Absolutely. Do I think they're going to just like totally fall? No. And if they do totally fall, I don't think it'll be because it's a bubble. I think it'll be because it's like some other reason, if the tech industry did leave the Bay Area en masse and home prices fell, that wouldn't really be a bubble, would it? It would be, a bunch of high income people left, right? I think though what you're getting at is, we have two problems. One is this kind of what we spent most of the time talking about, which is this crisis we're in, right? But this crisis is, of course, just the tip of a 40-year problem. And so how do we start to dig out from that 40-year problem while we're trying to sort of stave off, a sort of an acute eviction wave? I think the state is trying to do that, as we sort of said we might discuss, through building more housing, trying to make it easier to build more housing. I think it's going to take many years before you can even have any, amount of progress on that, because it took so long to get here. But the state is now the state and cities are trying to find ways to make it easier to build housing. That's just going to be a long digging out process. And a lot of people aren't going to like it, as we sort of saw when the state tried to do this duplex law last week. And then I think they officially passed it this week. A lot of people are unhappy with it.
Well, Connor, I know we have to let you go, so thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
No, I can stick around for a little bit. But
oh, okay. Well, can you stick around for about 7 more minutes?
Yes.
Okay, great. And let us know if you need to go. So we have a number of emails, and I'd love to get you both to respond to these emails. And again, that's Connor Doherty, economics reporter with the New York Times. Elizabeth Kneebone is research director for the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley. Leslie writes, the housing problem is dumped on local communities due to the predatory wage practices of corporations. Many people cannot afford housing because they're not paid fairly. Corporations need to be called out to take responsibility for inadequate wages for their lower paid employees, especially those they contract out to save money. And then Gary has a similar comment. Are we trending towards a renter society versus traditional home ownership? This appears to be more evidence of the increasing wealth gap, resulting eventually of a growing underclass of Americans. Important points, Elizabeth. How would you comment?
I think those are, I totally agree that those are very important comments, that yes, we need to build more housing. There is a housing part of the solution, but we can't build our way out of low wages. Like there also has to be, that's why it's like all of this, we often talk about policy in certain silos, but it's a multi-pronged challenge and it will take action at multiple points to address it. So you need both the sort of supply side, the housing actual stock, but the sort of quote unquote demand side is about how much are people actually making, if they're, you know, what kinds of jobs available, what kind of quality jobs available. And I agree that has to be part of the solution if we're going to fix this long term.
Another question, we have a number of questions about various like Airbnbs and VRBOs, but Wendy points out that there are countless others now in similar markets, Zeus, Living, Picasso. In addition, many people have more than one home. Indeed, much of the Tahoe Basin is full of second homes. All of this leads to less community, fewer homes at greater cost of entry to people of more modest means. We need policies that disincentivize this kind of resource hoarding. I wasn't familiar with Picasso, but another listener wrote to us about this, and I'll just read from this NPR piece. Picasso is buying homes in the Napa Valley. The company was co-founded by a Napa resident. It converts homes into LLCs and then sells shares of these corporate houses to multiple investors. The company named one house Chardonnay and was selling investors the chance to buy 1/8 share for $606,000. It was founded by two former executives at Zillow. So Connor, what are your thoughts on, in addition to the Airbnbs, these new companies like Picasso and how they're affecting the housing market?
So at the risk of sounding sort of heartless, I'm not that worried about... let me put it this way. We have always seen insane demand and things like timeshares and all sorts of different schemes to kind of chop up real estate in really ultra kind of resort type locations, right? You know, the timeshare in it, or its new internet sort of form, is not like a new thing, right? And whether it's Napa or Tahoe or any of these other kind of destination type places, they're always going to have, I mean, and I'm not saying it isn't important, but they are always going to have these sort of this kind of difficulty in dealing with a local workforce that is usually in a service sector and not paid that well, and a sort of very high income tourist kind of outsider base, right? I think that's a very common problem in all these places, and they do have to come up with workforce housing and all those things, I guess that is a particular challenge. I think that's a different challenge though than the sort of urban kind of the kind of like general city problem, which is, you know, where are people going to live and work, you know, for most of their lives, right? And I think that Airbnb and all these things have introduced a huge equation. I mean, wrench in this. Cities are trying to come up with new Airbnb regulations. Much like any of these rental registry things we've been talking about throughout this program, figuring out where they are, who owns them, getting the data from, that's all actually enforcing any of these laws. That's all becoming very difficult. This is adding a new equation, like I said, to this housing problem, and figuring out how to regulate it the same way we had to figure figure out how to regulate rents and all that sort of thing is going to be a huge part of this challenge. I think cities are working on that right now, and hopefully they eventually get to a place where they kind of start to figure it out. But it's like they're trying to catch up to these companies as they're growing so fast.
Elizabeth, we're almost out of time, but what are your thoughts on these companies and how they're changing communities?
I agree that this is just one more facet of a challenge that really comes from not having enough of a range of housing options in enough places. And that thinking about how local policy can effectively regulate that space is, I think it's a work in progress. But it's also sort of, I can see the tension at the local level too, of wanting to be able to allow for tourism in some of these places and to support that sort of local small business enterprise. But how do you balance that and not do it at the cost of long-term affordability for moderate and lower income households? And some of that is just making sure there is more housing built across the income distribution in these places.
Well, we've got a number of emails that we didn't have time for, but we will definitely revisit this show and do shows about the two zoning bills in California, which supporters say will tackle the state's housing crisis by building more housing. The question is, what will we do to ensure that affordable housing exists? And also, what does that mean? We just throw that word around, but affordable means very different things to different people. So we will definitely do a follow-up to this show very soon. Elizabeth Kneebone is Research Director for the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley. They come up with strategies to house families in vibrant, sustainable, and affordable homes. Elizabeth, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Connor Doherty is economics reporter with the New York Times and author of Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America. Connor, thank you for sticking with us and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, we'll find out why Democrats like Representative Josh Gottheimer of New Jersey are standing in the way of that $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill. We will bring you updates on the bill. Democrats cannot lose more than 3 votes in the House in order for it to pass. It does not need 1 Republican vote. And then later in the show, we'll talk about California's Prop 22. This allows Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, and other app-based companies to classify workers as independent contractors so they do not have to provide them with basic benefits. A California judge just ruled that the law is unconstitutional, so we will find out what this means. I hope you can join us for tomorrow's show. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. You can find all of our past shows. You can sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. You can also follow us and interact with us on Twitter @YourCallRadio. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.